Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist and security intelligence expert Paul Buchanan. And we will discuss whether the New Zealand Secret Intelligence, a Security Intelligence Service, has accepted its failure to identify and detect terrorist planning activity in the lead up to the tragedy that occurred in Christchurch against Muslim people on March 15, 2018. We'll also discuss, since the Christchurch terror attacks, after the Commission of Inquiry, after all the external and internal assessments and reports, should New Zealanders be satisfied that the New Zealand SIS is match fit, ready and resourced, equipped to identify extremist hate ideologies and prevent them from posing threats against the country's peoples? If not, what needs to change? But before we kick off this week's program, here's an invitation to you, those of you who are joining us live. If you are joining us via Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, feel free to make comments. And if you do, we'll be able to include your interaction in this program. Okay, so let's get the show on the road, as they say.
The Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Welcome to our audience, and also thank you, Paul, for your company today. And this is obviously a big issue and certainly one that's right in scope of our program of View From Afar. Paul, in the first instance, the March 15, 2018 terror attacks, should the New Zealand SIS, the Security Intelligence Service, should they accept any failure or even blame on this occasion?
Kia ora, Selwyn. Yes, I think they do, but they won't. We have a very unpleasant syndrome here, in part because the SIS is in fact in transition from a Cold War mindset with an old boys network running it into something else. What that else is, I still don't know. I was hoping that this would be a flexible, agile human intelligence agency. From everything they've done since March 15th, I think what they're basically good at is engaging in damage control and public relations, because in terms of addressing the failures that they may have committed by omission or commission in the lead up to the March 15th terrorist attacks, they really haven't been addressed, and no one's been held accountable, at least not in public. So what you wind up with is the sense that as far as the SIS was concerned, all their systems operated correctly. There were no systemic, institutional, or individual failures within the processes at the time. They keep on referring to their business model at the time. And I'll leave aside the fact that intelligence collection and analysis is not a business. The whole idea that you would transpose, your basic, management models onto something like an intelligence organization seems a little strange to me. But they surely internally know that something was amiss. And it may not have been principally the SIS's fault due to the division of labor when it comes to domestic intelligence gathering in New Zealand.
Again, well, whose fault would it be?
It harks back to the Cold War threats at the time. But it could well be that their responsibility was relatively light, and the onus of responsibility rests with other domestic security agencies, and therein lies the rub. What is clear, and the Royal Commission mentioned this, the internal report from the SIS alludes to it obliquely, the bottom line is that when it comes to domestic terrorists, on March 15th, 2019, they were looking the wrong way.
Okay, so we've had the annual review. The two security agencies fronted up on this, the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service and also the Government Communications Security Bureau. Yeah, so GCSB, and they appeared in Parliament only a day ago at the Select Committee, basically, that is charged to oversight their activities. Now, that was streamed live. There's been quite a number of news reports that have taken place. I'll just run through those. For example, at the spin-off, the headline there, Spy Chiefs Grilled About Priorities and Rare Public Appearance. One of the takeout points that the spin-off has honed in on is, it said, Kitteridge said, and I quote here, "We know we must do better, and we will." And she continued on by saying, "It is important to note that we did not wait for the findings of the Royal Commission before acting." Now, just on that point, Paul, what do you think that they did exactly? They didn't wait for the Royal Commission report to come out, that they started, one would take from that comment, that they started to improve and get things right, if you like. Is that how you read that?
Oh, well, I read a lot into that that committee hearing. First of all, let me set aside this. The GCSB, the Signals Intelligence Agency, which is the partner in the Five Eyes Signals Intelligence Network, the Anglophone Network, they sent up their deputy acting director because the director apparently was on medical leave. He was so comfortable that he decided not to show. Why? Because the GCSB has no responsibility for the blame and the March 15th attacks, because if they were to intercept or do something, you know, via electronic intercepts, that sort of thing domestically, they would have to be asked to do so by one of their domestic partners, i.e. the SIS or the police. And so they know that they have no blame in this. You know, that was not part of their charter. So they could front up nice and easy and talk about chatter on the internet and that sort of thing. And if you want, we can talk about that, because that's a failure that's common to many Western intelligence agencies, not paying attention to social media. Now, in terms of the SIS itself, the very fact that it began to engage in organizational reforms before the Royal Commission report tells us that, in spite of what they're saying publicly, they know that there were failures. They know that something was wrong. And so they went ahead and moved, and they moved not only because they knew.
They're saying proactively, before they're basically told or instructed or public opinion demands or the public interest demands that they make a shift. It seems to me quite vague on exactly what they did.
But you made an interesting point. First of all, they say proactively. No, proactive would be you moved against the terrorist before he acted. What this implies is that they don't act without some guidance from the government of the day or some independent reviewers. That's crazy. You know, you're there to assess threats, see them coming, triangulate on whether they're potential, possible, or imminent. And if you can, get out in front of them. Don't wait. They waited, or they did not know that this fellow was plotting and scheming. And if they're waiting for a commission to tell them what was wrong, there is something seriously wrong at the core of this intelligence agency. So what I think actually happened was, well, here's proof of that. In the 6 weeks after March 15th, the police let slip that 2,000 people were being monitored who were not being monitored prior to March 15th. Those people were right-wing extremists. People who were there on March 14th were not being looked at. And then in the aftermath of the Christchurch massacres, all of a sudden they became a priority. Well, I would imagine that
that's one of the points.
To monitor them were probably shared by the police and the SIS. So there was a lot of diplomatic talk in that committee hearing, And I think what it obscures, because it was designed to obscure rather than illuminate, is the fact that they got caught with their pants down, and now they're working really hard to pull them back up.
Well, we've got to pull them back up pretty quickly, because as News Hub's headline suggests here, New Zealand SIS top spy Rebecca Kitteridge tells group of powerful MPs there's no doubt white supremacy is on the rise. And she goes on to say here, and there's a quote that News Hub did here, it's not just that type of ideology, but actually we see kind of proliferation of different conspiracy theories and a whole range of different ideologies, all of which we need to be open to detecting and investigating. Now, those appraisal points are all well and good, Paul, aren't they? But we need to see some evidence, perhaps, of exactly what the spy agency is doing. But of course, when things go wrong, they become very obvious. When things go right, perhaps we don't know, and they're out of our scope on many occasions. News Hub also, which it pushed an angle in a second report. New Zealand spy agency, New Zealand SIS, intercepted multiple potential threats to the 2020 general election. Is this a situation where, Paul, the SIS is bringing this part into the public sphere to kind of show, well, we get some things right? And if so, is that satisfactory?
Yeah, trying to get the public involved a little more in reporting on odd behavior and whatnot is, you know, is salutary. That is good. And I think that interestingly, although at first glance you'd believe that the problem of extremism is separate and distinct from the problem of foreign interference in our elections, the fact is that foreign actors like to stir the pot in advance of elections in order to sow dissent, sow disharmony. If you think about the Russian hackers in US elections, they tried to exacerbate race conflict in the buildup to both the 2016 and 2020 elections. There is some suggestion that they try to do some of that here, that is Russians as opposed to Chinese or other foreign actors. So there is a nexus between the rise of certain types of extremism and foreign interference, although we need to separate between foreign aided and abetted extremism and then domestic extremism, which doesn't have the links other than the global links that are provided by the internet. Now, Director Kitteridge said a truth, but in a coy way. In 2011, Anders Breivik committed a mass murder, two mass murders in Norway. That's the worst case of right-wing terrorism in the last 20 to 30 years. He is the god of right-wing extremists. And after that, those attacks in 2011, there was a mounting wave of right-wing extremist attacks throughout Europe and North America. I mean, if we think of the attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh, the attack on Latinos in El Paso, the attacks in San Diego, and so on and so forth. But attacks in Germany, attacks in France by right-wingers on others, not always Muslims. The hard fact is that was building, and in 2015, global security organizations, including Interpol, were openly saying that the threat of right-wing extremism had surpassed that of jihadists. So this is no surprise that Rebecca Kitteridge would say, no, this has become a major threat. And so it's good that she recognizes it. The question, though, begs, why wasn't it recognized before March 15th, 2019, given that history? It had been building and building and building and building. And I would suggest to you the following, and it's not just a problem for New Zealand. And until the massacres hit home, the intelligence community tended to view right-wing extremists, neo-Nazis, skinheads, that sort of folk, as domestic law enforcement problems. They were a local problem for the police. And you may see what I'm hinting here. They did not see the problem as an international security threat in the measure that the jihadists were. The jihadists were all over the world. They were bombing in Bali and Madrid, London and Paris, committing attacks. So they were seen as an international security threat. And the alliance of civilized countries banded together against them. But white-wing extremists were seen as local yokels stirring up trouble until they started organizing online. And slowly but surely, as each massacre occurred, the country in which it occurred began to realize these guys are organized internationally. They're looking at each other's social media posts. And it took March 15th in New Zealand for the security authorities to realize we've been casting a blind eye in what is right under our noses. These guys are here. They've been here for a long time. We just never thought that they could commit something like this, even if the individual turned out to be a permanent resident Australian as opposed to a native-born Kiwi. But now, the fact that's a problem for all liberal democratic security agencies, one that just took us a little too long to realize.
Yeah. So let's get into solutions very soon. But in the first instance, I'd just like to, on screen, people that are watching this live will be able to see, I've brought up a statement that Scoop published, and that is from the Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand. And it says, and it's making references to the Arutaki report that the New Zealand SIS released, albeit in part redacted, but put it out there and made a big push by saying this is a part of us being more open with the New Zealand public by releasing the findings of this particular report. Now, there's an area here that I'd just like to highlight that the Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand has put in there. It says the Arutaki report was not an internal investigation. It was a learning or sharing project, as no one, and I'd say within the agencies, was required to participate. Anyone who had controversial information could have withheld it. The reviewer conducted a database search, but the report states that they can't guarantee that they got everything in that database. Intelligence officers are officers of this nation. Why did they get to choose to participate in this investigation? Paul, you raised something similar with respect to the Royal Commission. Have you got an answer for that?
Yeah, I can, and it'll reaffirm some of their concerns. First of all, by as an aside, if anyone thinks that Muslim women are subordinate and submissive, they need to look at these women here in New Zealand who run this organization. These people are fierce and determined. And if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't get a lot of answers because the other gendered side of the Muslim community would prefer to get along than pose hard questions on the authorities. Now, look, they're absolutely right. I think of it this way, Selwyn. Neither the Royal Commission nor the supposed independent inspector, who apparently is someone from another Five Eyes country,
We're not sure where from. Yeah.
Right. And you know, there's pluses and minuses there. But what's important to keep in mind is they did not exercise their hypothetical powers of compulsion under oath. No one in any of these investigations was compelled to testify under oath. They were brought in voluntarily. Now, both the internal review and the Royal Commission said, we did this because we fear that if we don't do this, that is, ask people to volunteer information rather than compel them, they won't tell us the truth.
Is that good enough, though, Paul? Is that good enough?
No, not at all. No. I mean, if that happens, they're perjuring themselves. There should be penalties, but that's the rub. The terms of reference were set up in such a way that people could tell their stories, not be challenged on them, and they would suffer no penalty for having told a fib or left out half of the equation and what have you. And that was done by design. And I think to myself, well, unlike, for example, the United States, which is a highly legalistic society, and everything is run through courts and all of that, which may be a bit too much, I think what probably is going on is that they listen to these stories, and this is what's going to come out for public consumption, that internally, quietly, the agencies will deal with those who have failed in their obligation, in their duty of care, because there may be issues of basic competence or of bias or of prejudice. I mean, human intelligence agencies and police organizations are made up of people, you know, with all of the things that go into humanity. And so I think, okay, this is a Kiwi way. You offer the public some milquetoast whitewashing. None of us did anything wrong. It's just we, you know, yeah, we were looking the other way, but our partners were as well. And so what do you expect of us? Now we're going to fix it. I think internally, there might have been a little sharper edges drawn on the who, what, when of the failures to anticipate this attack in light of the history, the mounting history of right-wing attacks. But if so, that's all redacted. That will be never known to the public. People may get golden handshakes and be forced into retirement. But none of that will become public knowledge. And that's the difference between transparency and accountability and public relations damage control.
Well, one of the areas
that we can see.
One of the areas that the New Zealand public has been assured that there is oversight and accountability is via the Parliament and the oversight committees in the intelligence security areas. Only yesterday, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, that there was an annual review where the SIS and the GCSB appear before the Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, the Leader of the Opposition Judith Collins, and others like a senior MPs, James Shaw, from Leader of the Green Party, co-leader of the Green Party, and Gerry Brownlee, who's got a long track record in the top echelons of the National Party at cabinet level when it was in power. Here's a couple of takeaway points, perhaps. Jacinda Ardern, people will hear Jacinda Ardern, the New Zealand Prime Minister, putting it to her spy chief, Rebecca Kitteridge, a few questions.
Violent extremism, whatever the ideology.
Just on that, and there's been a bit of discussion this week around the designation process for terrorist entities. And what you're speaking to is an increasingly complex environment where often, you know, those that might be motivated by violent extremism, regardless of the source of that motivation, are often more disparate and less well organized. So not in the usual frame of the way that we identify terrorist entities. How fit for purpose are some of those processes, acknowledging that that's not the only thing that we use as a driver to where we need to be looking?
So NZSIS doesn't have the lead on the designation.
I'm just interested in your opinion.
But I guess what I would say is that the Terrorism Suppression Act was passed, you know, after 9/11 in a particular context, and it sets a very high bar, actually, for designation of terrorist entities, including either an attack having occurred or having been planned, which, you know, means that for the kinds of ideologies we're talking about, actually it's pretty difficult to see how they fit into that legislative framework. And as I understand it, there's, a lot of work going on at the moment about that issue.
Yep. But are you seeing in more recent times that, you know, the different way that those groups that are motivated by those different ideologies, be it particularly white identity driven extremist groups. Can you describe for us a little bit how you see them organising slightly different or not organising at all?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the difference, I guess, is that you've got loose associations, often loose associations of people. There are some organisations that are quite tightly controlled, but others that are just people that are connected through the internet that don't even know one another's identities but are still sharing quite radical kinds of ideas. And for NZSIS, the challenge is that we are not, we don't monitor the entire internet. We are not conducting mass surveillance of New Zealanders. And we are also not focused on hate speech. Our specific area of interest and investigation is violent extremism or terrorism, where people are mobilizing to violence and in a way that is ideologically driven.
Okay, Paul, so we get the takeaway point there and the response from the SIS director there saying they're not monitoring all of the internet. Basically, they're acknowledging that white supremacism, the extremism, I should say, where the violence is ideologically driven is in scope. It's also suggesting that New Zealand legislation is not capturing the current legislation is not capturing the designation or the definition of terrorist groups satisfactorily, comparing it back, and it's referring to laws that came in the post 9/11 period. What do you make of all of this, Paul, what they're speaking to there? Is this a precursor to legislative reform where it will tidy up, or are they trying to say, well, you know, within the constraints of the law, we're doing the best we can?
She was being a bit, the director Kitteridge was being a bit precious there. There's good news and bad news in what she had to say. The good news is that it's not the specific nature of the ideology that matters. It's the behavior that follows that ideology. You and I have talked about the fact that I believe that we should treat terrorism as a criminal act. Not focus on the motives, focus on the mass murder or those sort of things, and treat them as criminals as opposed to political martyrs. I also agree that we shouldn't focus on whether the ideology is religious or secular. We focus on the violence that is being used under whatever that ideological justification may be. So the designation of ideological extremism as opposed to jihadists and white supremacists, I think is a good one. Mm. Now, the bad side of her answer was that for 50 years, there has been a concept amongst irregular warfare actors, and terrorism is a irregular warfare tactic, of leaderless resistance. Mm. It has been used by the left. It has been used by the right. It has been around for 50 years.
Is this kind of like the cell structure and that type of structure?
Yes. Exactly. So, yeah, see, you already know what I'm about to say. And that is the idea that if you don't want to hold territory, see, you organize guerrilla groups like Che Guevara, for example, because you're going to try to take over the state. You're going to occupy territory and become what they call an alternative sovereign, provide goods and services to people. If you're not interested in that, if you're interested in disrupting the social fabric, the body politic, you don't want to control territory, then leadership resistance is the way to go. And you organize small cell, lone wolf, those sort of activities independent of each other, but inspired by a very loosely defined common cause, which is precisely what is going on today with white supremacists, from those who follow QAnon to those who are part of the Atawafan division. That's the gamut of white supremacists. But what is the commonality? They use the internet to share their ideas and to plan. You know, someone says, well, this is how you make an explosive. This is, you know, a mall that has closed air conditioning things and no open windows is better for a chemical attack. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that they can share that doesn't rise to the threshold of criminality, but which, if you aggregate them, are clearly indicators of criminal intent. So
Kitteridge
said, oh, this is a new phenomena.
Yeah, Kitteridge makes mention of this transition toward violent ideology. That's what you're talking about here, isn't it? As it transcends across from the idea of developing the idea, maybe online, it may be in the dark web, maybe on the Chan sites or of some sort of representation of them, and then it's clear that things are becoming more imminent. Is that on the timeline scale where the SIS knows it has to actually be on point and it knows that it's got to act?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the stuff that I'm talking about didn't just happen now. It's been in play for at least a decade, okay, this type of organization. There is a thing, and I've written about it professionally in more academic forums, called institutional lag. And that's where, in the military business, it's where the generals are preparing for the last war, not for the next war. And so in the intelligence business, you're preparing and you're looking for the last threats, let's say jihadism, and you're not looking at the emergence of right-wing extremist threats because you've finally gotten good at dealing with the last one. Now, all of a sudden, you're surprised by the new one. Well, if you know you read the way I read, and I'm not saying I'm any better than these guys, but surely you would have seen this leadership resistance model being used by right-wing supremacists well in advance of March 15th. And that's what surprises me. Let me give you an example that I think will illustrate the point. From my regular, you know, looking at security things and whatnot, one of the major conduits for the radicalization of increasingly young people, to include teenagers, is online gaming. Interactive, violent games. Increasingly, white supremacist recruiters are going into these gaming forums, adopting characters. And by the way, you can adapt a character. You can be a crusader. You can be a World War II soldier. You can be a serial killer.
Living out the fantasy games. For some.
You know, for you and me, well, we wouldn't go into those games in the first place. But if we did, we'd want to be the good guy and save the damsel in distress and all that sort of stuff. But if you have sociopathic or psychopathic tendencies, if you got issues with by race or religion, and you go in there, you can act out some incredibly dark fantasies. And you know what? The recruiters, it started with jihadists actually going into those forums. But now there are right-wing recruiters, you know, supremacist recruiters in those forums all the time. So gaming has become a major, major problem when it comes to countering violent extremist threats because they're being urged to take the game into real life.
Yeah,
they're being urged
that.
By these people. Now, I would say this. If I know this and I'm not a gamer, I sure as heck hope that the security authorities are all over this like a rash.
Yeah.
To include infiltrating violent gaming fora to see, let's say in our case, if there are New Zealanders in there and they're adopting certain modalities that would indicate, A, they've got a penchant for violence, and B, that violence is ideologically driven against something else. That's a threat.
There's a flag there. At this point, we'll come to solutions just after this, which will be fascinating period. Interesting stuff there too, Paul. But we've got some comments that have come in, and I'd just like to catch up on a few of them there. David Mooring actually has been making some very good comments here, and I'll just bring some in. We're just going back in the conversation a little bit here. And David writes, given the amount of effort that the New Zealand security agencies have spent in the past with left-wing and ideological ecological groups, how difficult is it for the officers to infiltrate internet forums such as 4chan? It's a good question, Paul.
It's a good question, David, and it speaks to two things. One is generational. The older generation of human intelligence officers, what we call case officers, what people know as covert operatives, these people are used to the physical space. So adopting the mannerisms, I mean, that's the crowd that I used to hang out with back in the day. And so you learn languages, you learn how to pass in certain crowds, and you operate on an interpersonal basis, but interpersonal meaning in person. And you collect information on targeted agencies and individuals. In the online world, a lot of these older officers cannot cope. You know, they're not technologically savvy. They don't know the jargon, that sort of thing. So going on to a message forum like 4chan, 8chan, even simple things like Reddit, is actually a little bit daunting for them. And the SIS, although it has done a lot of recruiting of younger officers, its recruiting has been done basically according to the changing ethnic profile of New Zealand. So, for example, now we have a lot more SIS officers who are Asian and to some extent female than you used to have in the 1990s. But in terms of proficiency on the internet, they're still playing catch up, which, again, given everything I've said today, I find absolutely amazing. But I think therein lies the rub, is they simply don't have the dedicated number of people who can monitor these channels with any degree of efficiency. And hence, we saw a few weeks ago they needed to rely on a Crime Stoppers tip for the identification of an individual who is making serious threats against the mosque on the anniversary of March 15th.
There was a question in that the annual review came across from the Leader of the Opposition, Judith Collins, and basically where it boiled down to is she was asking the two representatives, two leaders of the intelligence agencies, New Zealand SIS and the GCSB representatives, whether or not they were adequately resourced. Did they need more money? And down in Parliament, we know that this is the pre-budget period where organisations and government departments, et cetera, via their ministers, are seeking assistance with respect to getting up to what they require from the budget that will be read in May. But, you know, it's an interesting time, an interesting question. I've got to say that the replies were very, they certainly weren't definitive from the agencies on that point. Now, once again, I was saying that David Mooring has put in some very good comments and questions today. And another one is, because of the ease of infiltration, we don't really need most of the security agencies. It could be handled by a halfway decent police intelligence unit. Now, that's a view that I think even at the annual review that we were mentioning was actually highlighted by the respondents representing the agencies, that there's a sector, or came in from Jerry Brownlee as well, there's a sector in New Zealand that believes there's no place for an intelligence agency. What do you say, just in brief, to that point, Paul?
The Royal Commission recommended that there be a reform of the New Zealand intelligence community, and I agree wholeheartedly with it. In part to separate out domestic intelligence collection functions from foreign intelligence and counterintelligence. All three of those tasks, by the way, on the human level, have to be done by the SIS, and they simply cannot do it with the personnel that they have. The agencies, look at the New Zealand intelligence community is very well resourced. It's the distribution of the resources within that community that is the problem. They got plenty of money. They don't have quite enough people for some of the things that they've been asked to. But for example, online monitoring is not one of them. They just need to put more eyeballs on screens, and they'll do a lot better with that. But certainly, David is right. If not a police unit, there needs to be a complete rethink of how we do domestic intelligence gathering, how intrusive it needs to be, depending on who's doing what. And let's remember one final thing. The war against extremism is a very small part of what intelligence agencies do. It's the sexy part that they bring out when they need money or when they're going to Parliament with their hands out. But that's not the bulk of what they do. Far from it. They spend most of their time with interstate espionage, with economic espionage by both state and non-state actors. So even though we talk a lot about the fight against extremists of any persuasion, that's only a fraction of what these agencies do, and that's where the resource divvying up the pie in these agencies becomes so important.
I'd add that there's a lot of vetting that goes on as well, you know, for potential employees across the government service, which must burden the agencies of resources.
Yeah, why are they doing that? Why would an intelligence agency do security vetting? I mean, you know, you could dedicate an agency to security vetting.
To just that. And specialize in it.
Collections agency.
And specialize in it. Yes, absolutely. So that's part of the solutions you've identified there as some efficiencies, targeting, you know, particular purposes. Certainly resource and funding and budget is always a part of the solution. Paul, if you were looking back from all of this and you had adequate resource, you had adequate commitment, you had a government that seems to be saying, come on now, get these, you know, white extremist, violent ideologies well and truly in scope, wherever they may be manifesting. If you had all of that in your hand, and it seems to be, I would suggest that is pretty close to it, what solutions would you do right now to pull in an effective security intelligence agency so that after all of these reports, after all of this discussion, that New Zealanders realised that they're probably safer in 2020? And I put a question mark on that, Paul.
Yeah, it would be twofold, given the parameter, the operative parameters of the system as given. I would do two things. I would make it an institutional imperative to look at threats objectively over the horizon and closer to home. By that I mean, don't be swayed by our intelligence partners' orientations. Don't be swayed by the government of the moment as to who might be a threat. Just objectively look at what's on the horizon and give the political leadership the heads up onto what is real and what is imaginary. Had they done that in 2015, 2016, our intelligence agencies would have known that right-wing extremism was on the rise here in New Zealand as well as elsewhere. A concrete measure in which to do this or to facilitate this is to improve the information and data sharing between the police and other intelligence agencies, because the police, of course, has an intelligence unit. What we discovered in these reports is that the intelligence units, there's at least 12 intelligence quote-unquote shops in New Zealand. Who knows what most of these guys do? But what we do know is that the police intelligence units are siloed away from those of the SIS, and they do not share information as a regular course.
Although the director of the SIS made mention in the annual review as she presented to the politicians, to the leadership group, that she was satisfied that was improving, that efforts were made to get that communication working well, that the relationship between the New Zealand SIS and the police intelligence units was in scope and improving. Do you feel that response from her was satisfactory in that regard?
Well, it may be true, but it's not satisfactory. I mean, the fact is that by even saying that, she's admitting that there wasn't good data sharing.
Yeah.
And you realize that she's subtly pointing the finger at the police. I mean, this whole thing is incredible because the police must be sitting there. They haven't offered a internal review of their own. And they're like, man, we're getting thrown under the bus subtly, because let's say, for the sake of argument, that in the course of a drugs investigation, they hear some skinhead saying that they're arming themselves to attack a mosque. Mm. Now, the police are focused on criminality, not ideology. And in the siloed structure of their intelligence gathering, they would not pass that information on to the SIS. They would say, okay, that's just talk. We got to focus on the drug trade. In a more professional setting or more professional network arrangement between intelligence agencies, the cops would go, ooh, that's not nice talk. Let our friends over in the SIS know about that and go, okay, here's who we're looking at. We can't do anything about their ideological talk because, you know, we're in the middle of a drugs investigation, but you might want to look into this. These guys are saying they're arming themselves, or they heard about a guy who came over from Australia, who's arming himself, this, that, and the other. Mm. Apparently, none of that happened. So the SIS can claim legitimately that this fellow flew under the radar and they had no clue about him at all, which, you know, if ever there was an admission of failure, that would be it. But what I'm reading is they're going, well, we might have had a clue if someone who was actually working the ground in and around Christchurch during that period of time had given us a heads up as a sidebar to the main work that there was something a little weird about this crowd or what they had heard. And under the previous structure, again, the business model that was operating on March 15th, there was no regular channels of communication horizontally between the two main domestic intelligence agencies, which are those of the police and the SIS. And if that's improving, great, but quite frankly, too little too late.
Yeah, we'll be watching this issue, obviously, very, very closely. And we'll be coming back with programs that address issues that we're raising here in both positive and in challenging areas as well. Paul, thank you for your company, and thanks for the company of our audience here as well. We look forward to coming back with another episode of A View from Afar, this time next week. And until that time, take care and be safe.